Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
What is more difficult? Mm. Reverse parking blindfold, mm-hmm. a handbrake on, mm. or teaching my dad how to use FaceTime?
I think that's an obvious one, isn't it? It's yes. the second answer.
I've just spent 45 minutes to look at the top of his head. Oh, I think bless. It's his head. I mean, oh. I don't know. I mean, bless. I think it might be easier to teach an octopus.
I think
this.
You could be right. You could yes. be right. Well, I get my dad's nostrils on FaceTime. That's quite nice. Right up his nostrils.
Why is this so? Do you think this is going to happen to us?
Definitely.
Tish? There are warning signs, aren't there, already?
Definitely. There will be. We're not very good at tech in the best of
No.
So imagine in 20 years when we're a bit deaf and, you know, we've got hairy nostrils, it's going to be a disaster.
Well, it'll all be advanced as well then, won't it? You'll be able to maybe hologram yourself.
Oh, God.
Into your children's front room.
That is terrible the price thought. They will pay for all the mean things they
exactly.
do to us right now.
Serve them right to get a naked hologram of me of a Sunday morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to Postcards from Midlife. I'm Trish Halpin.
And I'm Lorraine Candy, and we're on a mission to help you make the most of your magnificent midlife. We'll be tackling everything from mind and body wellness to HRT and your sex drive. Trish and I are here to help you have a stylish second act and answer all your midlife questions on fashion, beauty, careers, relationships, family, and as always, the challenges and joys of parenting teens.
In today's episode, we're going to be talking to Dr. Paula Briggs, a sexual and reproductive health expert who is also a menopause specialist. And we'll be asking her about some of the trials and tribulations we can suffer down below at this life stage.
Down below, Trish, is that how we're referring to it? Could we not say vulva and vagina?
You could do, but let's not go there quite so early in the show, shall we? You know what I did there, Lorraine, don't you? Yeah. I was a bit of a fun sponge, wasn't I, on your kind of chat? Well, it's quite apt because we're going to be discussing being fun sponges in jibber jabber, as it's something that drives us a bit mad when our husbands and kids accuse us of sucking the fun out of things or being nags or, heaven forbid, boring.
Yes, it always seems to be the mums, doesn't it? We are the ones that have to be sensible, at least some of the time, and we are the ones that have to think about everything. I think it's called emotional labour. Mm. Don't get me started. I will... keep a lid on that until a bit later on. What else have we got coming up?
Well, after our interview with Dr. Briggs, it's How to Win at Midlife, in which we'll be tackling the tricky topic of teens and food. How do we drag them away from those pot noodles and get them to eat healthily? Should we tiptoe around our daughters for fear of giving them body image issues in later life? Well, we have some expert advice on these dilemmas and much more. You know how we were talking at the beginning of the show about your OAP dad and technology?
80 years old, yes.
Oh, bless him. Well, the other day I had organised a birthday Zoom for the twins. They turned 17 and with two...
They what? They turned 17?
17.
Goodness
so
me.
I thought, well, obviously they can't see anybody. So we organised a Zoom with the grandparents. And you can imagine what that was like. You know, four deaf, old... Oh, lovely, lovely people, but Zooms, I think, are difficult enough at the best of times. But when you've kind of got groups of people all together and nobody's listening...
Done you for sorting it.
Well, I did, exactly. That's the thing. I managed to actually get them all on there after a bit of faffing about. But, you know, would the kids pay attention? Would Neil pay attention? You know, he's kind of like prodding them, making them laugh, having conversations with the kids off screen. I'm like, come so on, nice. You've got to concentrate. And it's like prodding the kids to like ask questions and answer. And of course, at the end of it, I get told that I'm this sort of being so serious and no fun and da da da, all of that, which kind of really annoyed me because I thought, actually, I'm trying to do a nice thing here and I'm looking out for the old people and I'm trying to be nice to you guys. Yeah, I'm some boring old, you know, fun sponge, basically. Really,
it's very, very annoying. I guess it comes under that emotional labour description, which I kind of become gendered, that description. But I know exactly what you mean, because I had a similar thing. It just makes me so cross, because it puts me into, particularly because I am not a fun sponge, Trish. Mm-hmm. I embrace the fun as heartily as I can. But I remember when Henry was quite small, he must have been, this is my son, he's 14. He must have been about three and a half, mm-hmm. four. And we were with a group of friends on the beach, bank holiday, August bank holiday, packed beach in Cornwall, lots of people, lots of kids. And the dads sent the kids just out of eyesight, a little bit out of eyesight, to play cricket. And they said, oh, he was four, that's it, you can, he can go. And I said, oh, I think he's a bit young. And they said, oh no, he'll love it, don't be ridiculous, of course, let him go. Against my judgment, I let him go. And obviously that was the last we saw of him for two hours.
Gosh. Oh no.
Absolutely the worst day, one of my worst days parenting ever, I think. Yeah. I mean, the whole world just went dark. He was wearing a stripy top, and every kid is wearing a stripy top on the beach in the summer. And I was so cross. Cross I'd ignored my instinct. Cross they'd called me a fun sponge for not letting him go. And it was only because a friend of ours had been walking up a cliff and she had spotted him walking away, and she was kind of coming back to tell us, and we'd obviously all dispersed by the time she came, and he'd walked all the way across the beach, quite, you know, about a 10-15 minute walk to the ice cream van, because he loved an ice cream van. But actually it really signified how annoying it is to be called a fun sponge. And I know that thenceforth I always say, remember Henry in the ice cream van, the day we nearly lost our son, drowned in a rock pool, etc. But it is something that I think maybe Gen X men, we're in this kind of very gendered roles, and this is stereotypical of how we're supposed to be, and it's reinforced with movies, cinema, soap operas, it's reinforced with all the greeting cards, you know, mum is the sensible one, it's reinforced on all the social media, TikTok is full of memes with go ask mum, as in go ask the manager. It's just quite annoying, isn't it? I'm not sure what you do about it. My husband often buys secret crisps and secret sweets as well when I'm on a kind of go healthy binge.
Right. And then so he's kind of like the fun dad, he's, and you're the one banning the food. It's kind of annoying. I've had that as well, sort of on holidays, where I've been known to storm out of restaurants when, you know, because I'm trying to stop Neil ordering like the fourth round of Cokes for the kids. And you're just like, I'm sitting here nagging. And I hate that word. It's a very contentious word, isn't it? Nag, because it's only ever associated with women. And usually it's when we want something from a man, when we're asking them to do something, whether it's to help out around the house or change their behavior in some way, you know, we are the nag. And I kind of worry that our children grow up thinking that mums, that older women, on eggs, you know, because we are mums and we are having to be sensible sometimes.
And it's our job to remember birthdays, to know what time it is during the day. It feels like it's kind of such a consistent message for this generation, and it really isn't fair in a way. I guess that's why it's a kind of small thing, but it's also a really big thing, isn't it? Because it makes us people we don't want to be, and we're just kind of looking out. Or conversely, are we not relaxed enough? Are we looking out for too much? Are we kind of sheepdogging everything when we could relax a bit?
I am a bit of a health and safety monitor, and sometimes I kind of go into overdrive. So how about this one? So my son came home the other day with this large bottle of, like, big litre bottle of Coke. I said, where did you get that bottle from? Because we don't really buy that. And it had a post-it note on it, and it said, you can drink me. And he picked it up on the road. So this big bottle of Coke.
I can see Neil doing that, you see.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like father, like son. But I was like, what on earth are you thinking? Like, we're in the middle of a pandemic. There are germs everywhere. Novichok. It could be spiked with Novichok.
Don't worry.
Obviously, I'd go a bit extreme in my fun sponge-ness. But I was just literally like, and he went, no, look. And he opened the top and went, look, there's the hiss. It's obviously sealed. And I was like, well, I don't want that in the house. And of course, I ended up finding it in the fridge. We've got this very small fridge in the utility room that's a bit of an overflow fridge. He'd popped it in there on its side and it spilt out everywhere, over the place. And I'm the fun sponge. I mean,
I guess what it's about is it's just inequality, isn't it, Trish? Yes. It's constant inequality in the home. Well, I'll tell you what, next week I'm going to be the fun queen. I'm going to be the monitor of all, the instigator of all things fun.
We had a great post on Facebook this week from one of our members called Melanie, who put up a picture of herself, which is basically her kids telling her she's a fun sponge, because it was basically her in this chef's hat that her daughter had bought her for a birthday present. And the reason her teenage daughter had bought it because she was fed up of finding bits of mum's hair in the food. I was like, so you're basically saying, you are a skivvy, you are my chef, but stop ruining my dinner, please. Just be furious.
There'll be a revolution of the fun sponges soon. Watch out for it.
The fun sponges are going to rise up.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's guest is menopause specialist Dr. Paula Briggs, who will be tackling the sexual health taboos that affect almost all peri- or postmenopausal women, the things we don't like talking about out loud. Paula, 57, is a sexual and reproductive health consultant for the NHS based at Liverpool Women's Hospital. A mum of four, she's been a menopause specialist since 1993 and has helped treat thousands of women, many of whom were suffering in silence. So welcome, Paula.
Good afternoon. It's lovely to be here.
Now, we're going to get right to the nitty gritty at the beginning of this conversation, because sexual health in midlife is one of those subjects that Gen X perhaps still have some difficulty talking about, particularly face to face. So tell us exactly what you do and which body parts this involves for women in midlife.
I'm a consultant in sexual and reproductive health. So that covers the full range of medical gynecology, including menopause, and also contraception. Contraception is required until the age of 55, which lots of women are unaware of, and sexually transmitted infections. In my day-to-day job, I deliver a menopause service, either by telephone or face-to-face. I also work in a vulval clinic. And I'm undertaking research supported by the University of Liverpool to help diagnose urogenital atrophy, which is, I think, at the moment underdiagnosed and therefore undertreated.
What is that?
That is the effect of lack of estrogen, usually post-menopause, but not always. It can happen to women who are breastfeeding, women who are using certain types of contraception like Depo-Provera. But usually post-menopause, urogenital tissue quality, depending on the individual, is sensitive to the reduction in estrogen and also testosterone.
That's a vagina you're talking about.
Yeah. What kind of problems does that cause, Paula? Because obviously we probably immediately jump to maybe sort of problems, during intercourse. But are there other kind of issues that it causes as well?
Yeah, there are loads of issues. And I think Lorraine, on what am I actually talking about? So it's not just the vagina, it's the vulva, which is the outside part. Also the bladder and the urethra. These tissues all come from the same source embryologically. And when it comes to symptoms, Trish, I think common things which would be useful if women were aware of the potential link with menopause are vaginal itching, burning, dryness, and pain during sex. And those are reasonably simple things to cover in just an opening question. Have you had any of the following? But I think it doesn't always get asked in a consultation.
And you've been then on the menopause frontline for almost 30 years. You've been doing it since 1993. So are women getting better about talking to their GPs about their sexual health? Would someone come and say to you, I have
problems with my vagina, my vulva, etc., or not. Has it got better?
No, it hasn't got better.
Oh, it's a shame, isn't it?
It's a massive hurdle. It takes a lot to build up the confidence to see someone about the potential problem. And during the consultation, they probably are gauging whether this person is the right person to have the conversation with. And, you know, they may decide at the end then, yes, I'm just going to have to get this off my chest. And if they don't then get the right response, it's fairly devastating, because it's such a difficult thing to deal with, you know, to discuss. It's a two-part problem. It's not just the woman's problem, it's also the healthcare provider, and it could be a doctor or a nurse who may not feel able to discuss the problem, partly because they don't know what treatments are potentially available.
When we chatted before, you said to me that 50 to 80% of women in midlife will have a varying degree of vaginal atrophy. So this is a huge problem that affects the majority of midlife women. And it's just still a sort of terrible secret we all keep.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the number of women that get away without a problem are small. It's always better to be aware that this might happen. And I think we also talked about the fact that it doesn't always happen during the perimenopause, the menopause transition, or immediately postmenopause. It may occur several years later, by which time that potential association has been lost. So the patient, the woman herself, may not think, my goodness, I've got vaginal dryness, it must be because I'm lacking estrogen. She just thinks maybe this is just what happens when you get older. And chances are her mother never talked about it to her. Even amongst women, I think it's probably not a common topic of conversation. I think
we don't talk about it, do we, Trish?
No, we don't. I mean, we talk about menopause generally, and some of the more, you know, there's so many symptoms, as of course you know, but we'd be quite shy and embarrassed to talk about that kind of level of intimacy. So it's a hard thing, I think, for women to discuss. You've talked about the symptoms of the sort of itching, burning, all of these kind of things. So what can be done about it?
So in an ideal world, the woman will present to somebody who might consider this as a potential diagnosis. It's important that a woman is examined, because it could be something else. You know, it could be worst case scenario, it could be a, you know, cancer of the vagina. And that's what's really important, is that we don't just make an assumption that it's urogenital atrophy because it's a woman of a certain age. And the kind of things that we would be looking for would be changes in skin colour, changes in elasticity. Sometimes the opening to the vagina just becomes sort of less robust. So I kind of have a theory that the menopause will affect us all in different ways. Some women get short-term symptoms like hot flushes and night sweats. Other women will be affected by cardiovascular disease or osteoporosis. And then as the years go by, the chances of getting urogenital atrophy become progressively more likely.
And how do you treat that?
That can be treated in a variety of different ways. We have lots of options now. So that's a fantastic question. It's not just vaginal moisturisers and lubricants.
Sounds painful. Any treatment for this, is it painful?
It's potentially very painful. So anything that's cooling, soothing, lubricating logically would help. And then if we think about the underlying cause being lack of estrogen.
Yeah.
Then replacing estrogen locally, so not in the same way as we would deliver HRT, and some women on HRT get this condition, but giving either estradiol or estriol in a variety of different ways. That might be a cream or a pellet or a gel or a waxy pessary or a ring. You know, there's lots and lots of different options with regards to replacing the deficient hormone. And then if those don't work, we can move on to some of the newer treatment options, which include DHEA. That's a precursor hormone, and that gets converted in the vaginal mucosa to both estrogen and testosterone. And we know that testosterone is important, but there are no standalone preparations. So that's a fantastic new, relatively new product. And then osfemafine is an oral medication that has a preferential effect on the vaginal mucosa. And I think, Lorraine, you, or might have been you, Trish, made the point that this is a painful condition. Yeah. And if you have a pain, do you want to constantly be doing something to that area? So putting a pessary in every day might not be suitable for all women. And then finally, there is now the option of laser therapy. So far, pretty much in the private sector, but NICE are currently reviewing laser therapy as a novel approach to managing women with this condition. And it's particularly important for women with cancer who may not be able to or may not want to use hormonal therapy because of anxiety about that inducing a recurrence of their cancer.
If one of our listeners thinks, gosh, this is me, this is what's happening to me, and they go to their GP, can we expect our GPs to have this level of knowledge? Or should they be referring us onto a specialist?
I think that's really variable. I think what's important, and with many vulval conditions, not just urogenital atrophy, lichen sclerosis as well, the patient can become very informed to understand what would be a kind of red flag symptoms. If the woman doesn't feel that she's getting the right treatment from her GP, then she needs to ask to be referred. I think the problem at the moment is on the NHS, it's very difficult to access clinics. But what we do in the vulval clinic where I work is, well, one of my colleagues will go through all of the referrals and pull out things that she would deem to be more high risk.
Mm-hmm. You must see women in pretty desperate, kind of tearful.
Yeah. And so on Monday, I saw a patient who was very happy for me to talk about her case. She had a hysterectomy when she was relatively young. By relatively young, I mean in her 40s, and had real struggles getting the right HRT and the right treatment for urogenital atrophy. And she traveled 3 hours to see me because I think she belongs to a chat group and somebody else had been talking about the treatment that they'd had. And, you know, she just broke down. And it wasn't because I was offering her outstanding treatment. I was just listening to what she had to say and telling her there were different treatments available. And she had not had that response. Basically, she had been told it's vaginal estrogen or there isn't anything else. And actually, she hadn't really had an adequate trial of vaginal estrogen. It hadn't been used for long enough.
Do people present with different midlife problems that lead you to kind of gradually and forensically uncover what they're really trying to tell you? Because we often hear that from women in midlife, that they go in and say, I think I've got depression, but actually it isn't. It's lack of estrogen, testosterone. So does that happen with your speciality?
It does happen. But if we're focusing on this condition, I would always ask. And I don't, as I said before, I think it's a fairly simple question. Something like, when did you last have sex? And that may be all they need to kind of start the conversation about what's going on. And sometimes they'll present with, I'm just not interested in sex. Well, you wouldn't be if it was going to be extremely uncomfortable, would you? So, and there could be two things going on. It might be that there is a problem with systemic levels of testosterone. We know that female ovaries produce lots of testosterone and they do it less efficiently from about the age of 20 onwards. But as you get older, you have less, and that will affect your sex drive, your drive generally, your kind of brain fog and aching or other problems that are associated with lack of testosterone. So yeah, there's often more than one thing.
We do have some listeners in their like late 30s before coming into the perimenopause phase, because our aim with this podcast is to get women informed before.
Yeah.
Is there anything they can be doing about this particular issue or be aware of? Or is it just a case of just be aware of the symptoms and get to a doctor early to talk about them?
There isn't really anything lifestyle-y with this. So I think it's important that women are provided with the right information about everything to do with our bodies. And as you say, younger women, it might not be that they're menopausal, but actually contraception could be very important. Mm-hmm. And that can have a beneficial or a detrimental effect on vaginal health. It's just not talked about, is it? It's not socially acceptable to go around talking about your vagina. I had a really interesting Zoom call with a pharmaceutical rep yesterday who said she was a Muslim woman. She'd never mentioned the word vagina, and she must have then mentioned it about 20 or 30 times. So she'd really cracked that nut.
Good.
If this was men and there was something wrong with them, we would be hearing all about it. I think women very much put up with what they get and they just get on with it. And there's so much that we could do to make things better by providing the right information so that women think when it happens, a little bit of vaginal itching, it's possibly because I'm either on a certain type of contraception or I'm breastfeeding, or, oh my God, maybe it's the menopause and there are lots of treatments. I actually think when you're talking about depression, it is depressing when you don't know what's going on. You don't know who to help you. You don't know what treatment options are available. And you think this might be it. Who knows? This might be it. No no sex ever again, and you're only in your early 40s or 50s.
You've said that you can still get this if you're taking HRT, but the whole kind of controversy and attitude around HRT, and also around women having to put up with a certain level of pain because it's kind of expected. Do you still encounter that within the profession? There's still a sort of reluctance within GPs to talk about their own perimenopause and menopausal symptoms, their own need to take HRT, isn't there?
I think all doctors find it very difficult. I think, you know, we talked about the BMA survey, which showed that 90% of doctors really struggle with where to go with menopausal symptoms. And instead of finding the right person, they work part-time rather than full-time. And actually, in the current climate, we need all the doctors we can get. So if we can make it better for our healthcare professionals, then I think that will take us a long way. And I also think if we can inform women and inform GPs about urogenital atrophy, that has a huge potential for long-term savings in women who are maybe on antidepressants that they don't need, or they may be on long-term antibiotics, they may be having bladder washouts, they might be taking drugs for overactive bladder that they don't need. I'm not saying all of them by any means, but I'm sure there's lots of crossover between specialties.
We were talking about sex, obviously, in midlife, and it can become an issue around menopause, but there's also the other side around people going into new relationships. And I know a few years ago it was stated that there was a rise in sexually transmitted infections in people in midlife and beyond. Is that something you deal with at your clinic as well? Because that must add another layer of complication.
Well, very much so, I think. And the future is to work much more closely with genitourinary medicine and sexual health. I'm obviously at the moment now in secondary care gynecology, but these things are all joined up. Mm-hmm. Sexually transmitted infection rates are increasing across the board, but most resources being channeled into the under 25s. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we have to recognise actually that many women will stay in a marriage because they have children. When the children go, actually, they no longer need to stay within that relationship, and they will often develop new relationships, exposure to new potential STIs, particularly HPV. Mm-hmm. Because we virtually all, you know, I suppose at some point will have been exposed to HPV, but not necessarily all of the strains. So that sort of information is important. And HIV, do people think I might get HIV if I'm in this heterosexual relationship? Well, possibly not. I think basically any woman's at risk if she's in a new sexual relationship.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what age you are, you do need to be using protection. You need to be using condoms with new sexual partners.
And do women talk about their sexual relations with you? Is that something that they're finding easier to talk about since you started sort of in the 90s?
Yes, and I think that comes down to how comfortable the person asking the question is. So, you know, if you're reasonably matter of fact, you know, make the point that this is something that all patients are asked about, maybe numbers of sexual partners in the last 6 months, the reasons for that, to make sure that we don't miss a diagnosis. Yeah. You know, one of my issues is around that idea that you no longer need contraception in your 40s. In the abortion service that I work in now, in the previous one, we had lots and lots of women in their 40s presenting with an unplanned pregnancy, and it's worse for them because they just don't expect it.
Do you think GPs are becoming more knowledgeable about the menopause? Well, it's every day we get posts on our Facebook group of women saying, we had a woman say, my GP says he won't pump me full of hormones, so I can't get HRT. Do you think GPs are getting better?
I don't know if they're getting better yet, but I think there are lots of plans in place, collaboration with the pharmaceutical industry, not about their product, but about working together to improve
the narrative.
So personally, I think there is quite a lot of training out there for GPs. It's a very, very hard job. You cannot be good at everything. And I think support for GPs is really important. So I would like to think within the area that I work in, that I'd be reasonably well known to the GPs, that they would feel comfortable to email or to text and say, is this the right thing to do? And we've got lots of projects on the go, kind of tear-off slips for women, so that it's easier to engage in a conversation. You know, you take your piece of paper and that's the opener to the conversation, and some kind of online resources, very simple, punchy information for GPs, and mentorship. And then there are specialist qualifications, but they're probably too high level for the vast majority of GPs who are not delivering a specialist service. So, you know, I work in a tertiary referral centre. We see lots of women with cancer or who have significant risks. For example, they might have had blood clots. And that's very appropriate. But I would like to think that the women who have no specific personal history or family history could be provided with HRT by their GP following the NICE guidelines.
Mm-hmm. And we've been sort of reading about there possibly being an attempt to kind of rebrand HRT as MHT, menopause hormone treatment,
yeah.
Which we assume is that as a result of kind of all the negative connotations and connections between HRT and breast cancer?
It is. And I'm really glad you brought that up. And I have a sort of personal opinion on that, that and we actually recently did a patient participation group for the menopause booklet that I wrote a couple of years ago that's been made electronic. But patients don't want to change the name. They like the name. Mm-hmm. So the International Menopause Society have rebranded HRT as menopausal hormone therapy, MHT, to get away from the influence of the Women's Health Initiative study in 2002, which basically did cause about 15 years of detriment.
Yeah.
And it's the same, though, with urogenital atrophy. I'm doing a systematic review for my research, and I've just put in 10 different terms into a search engine, including things like urogenital atrophy, vaginal atrophy, senile vaginitis, vulvovaginitis. And that's all not helping with the diagnosis. And now they've decided to call it genitourinary syndrome of menopause. Well, you know, that's a massive, great big mouthful, and it sounds really scary, and it's really not helpful.
That's very off-putting, isn't it, for women?
Very off-putting.
Feel like something terminal if you...
Exactly.
It's confusing.
So I think all of that changing the name of stuff is unhelpful, and we should go with what patients feel comfortable with. Mm-hmm. Urogenital atrophy is the British Menopause Society term. I think it says everything we need to know. It's a change in tissue quality in the bladder, vagina, vulva, and usually that's due to lack of estrogen.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm someone with any of those symptoms going to my doctor, and I'm just stood outside the door thinking, I can't talk about this. It's too embarrassing.
Yeah.
How do I motivate myself when I go in to say, this is on fire, or these are my symptoms, or, you know, it's just can't have sex anymore. How do I get over that as a woman?
The patient facing arm of the British Menopause Society have a really good resource, and it includes terminology for...
Where would you find that?
On the British Menopause Society website.
Right.
So Women's Health Concern will be accessible through that website.
The language.
Yeah, and then recently we contributed to an embarrassing problem website for Karger, who are a well-known publisher. They're also really interested to pick up on the podcast today, because actually there's stuff about STIs, about contraception, and it's not age-related in any way, so patients could get lots of useful information.
That's Karger.
Karger, K-A-R-G-E-R.
Okay, we'll have a look at that. You mentioned a menopause booklet that you've written, Paula, that's now online. Where can that be found?
It's in the process of being updated, and it will go online via Theramex, which is a pharmaceutical company's home site, but I think it may be available elsewhere. That'll be free of charge. And one of the reasons for having the patient involvement was it's quite a high-level booklet with lots of information, and I wondered if we should be cutting that back. But actually, the patients were keen to retain the information and just to pick up on the bits that were relevant to them. So there's quite a lot of pictures, boxes to record their own symptoms, which I think is useful. And again, if you're looking at an easy way of engaging with your GP, for example, to take your booklet and say, look, this is what I've had in the last month, and this is what I think I've got, that I think would help.
When do you think that will be available?
Within the next few weeks, I think.
Oh, perfect. Okay, so we'll get that information. And you say it's on the Theramex home website. Yeah. What is Theramex then?
They're a pharmaceutical company that make various different HRT products.
Great. Okay, that's really helpful.
They make the DHEA product that I mentioned as a sort of second line treatment for urogenital atrophy.
Is there anything we can get just over the counter if we have sort of more minor symptoms, or would you always recommend seeing a doctor?
I think if it's a really sort of early case and it may just be dryness that's the problem, you can get some amazing lubricants over the counter or online. There is talk of vaginal estrogen becoming available over the counter.
Oh, good.
It's not at the moment, but, you know, that's a potential development. And I think the only woman that would really need to avoid any hormonal treatments are women who are using specific treatment for breast cancer and aromatase inhibitor, because that's really designed to get rid of all estrogen. For those patients, often the atrophy is very severe because they have no estrogen, pretty much. And I think lubricants and moisturizers will often not be sufficient. And those are the patients that in the future, I would like to think that we could offer laser therapy to. I visited a clinic in Italy, loads of patients coming in with a variety of different cancers, having laser therapy with very good outcomes.
What does it actually do, the laser therapy?
So what it does is it causes micro abrasions, so tiny little bits of damage, but there's lots of good tissue left behind, and that stimulates fibroblasts, which lie dormant as fibrocytes, and those are the cells which make connective tissue. And interestingly, sexual activity will do something quite similar. So it causes...
Also, we should keep having sex as much as
we can. There is a theory, use it or lose it, which not all women like to hear. And also we think that semen contains something which is helpful for vaginal mucosa. I mean, the superficial cells in the vagina shed every 4 hours and they contain...
What?
Lots of glycogen.
I don't know anything about my vagina, Trish. No. I've realised I've got to 52 and it's a complete mystery
me. Never too late. So those superficial cells contain lots of glycogen that promotes lactic acid, lactobacilli, which are healthy vaginal bacteria. And that keeps all the other bacteria, which are normal, and they're normally there at bay. But if those aren't kept under control, then things like E. coli can overgrow, and that increases the risk of urinary tract infection.
Oh, right. Goodness.
So you've been treating women in various states of distress, you know, and embarrassed and worried about talking about it. They must be hugely relieved when they see you. Have you got any cases that are really uplifting that would kind of inspire?
I've got an amazing
our listeners to go in and
an amazing patient who I met, and she's a big character, and she'd been to at least 6 different doctors, and she'd been told a variety of different things that she might have had wrong with her, none of which were actually true. I mean, she's had allegedly thrush, bacterial vaginosis, urinary disorders, and she eventually pitched up with me in an NHS clinic, but we provided her with laser treatment in the private sector because that's what we've got at the moment. And she required 4 treatments. It's 3 to 5 treatments, 4 to 6 weeks apart. And she's just emailed me recently saying basically we were grieving for our sex life, and she and her husband are in their early 50s and they hadn't been able to have sex for some time. And how much they appreciate what was done, because although it was a financial burden for them, it was a big outlay, that is a really important part of your relationship. And of course, it depends on the couple. If both partners don't want sex, that's different, isn't it? If one wants it and the other one doesn't, that's also potentially a different situation. But in this particular situation, this particular relationship, sex was a very important thing for them. And I see that a lot. And I think if you ask the question sensitively, lots of women will actually say, yeah, well, yes, actually, it is really important and we really enjoy it. And it's something we want to be able to continue to be able to do. And, you know, there's no reason why that.
Well, it saved a marriage. That's a lovely thing, isn't it?
And I don't think he would have left her, but it saved the marriage to what it had always been. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to put up with. That's the thing, isn't it, Trish? We don't have to put up with all these symptoms. Yeah. And I guess you can ask for a second opinion. If you go to your doctor and they say, we're going to give you antibiotics, antidepressants, you can say, can I have a second opinion? And then you get asked to be referred, don't you, somewhere else?
Yeah, and I think that can be quite a challenge, and it depends how feisty a character you are. But you are, well, every patient is entitled to the right opinion. I was also going to say that sometimes if sex has been impossible and there is that kind of head in the sand approach, so you mightn't think about dealing with it for several years, and then if it does come above the parapet, and it's usually because women think their partner is going to leave them, and we've seen that lots of times, then even the right treatment with the right end result doesn't always mean that sex is possible, because it's become like such a great elephant in the room. So sometimes we have to have the support of specialist physiotherapists who, you know, every team I've worked in, the specialist physiotherapists have been amazing to help relax the pelvic floor. And also psychosexual counselling.
So all that's available then, psychosexual counselling?
Within the unit I work in, we have all of that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's really good news.
That is. I've just got a bit of a nosy question. What kind of physiotherapists do to your pelvis then to relax it?
The thing about this...
We've spent years tightening the bloody thing.
I know, exactly. Trying to get pelvic floors. They've taken such a bashing over the years, haven't they?
Yeah, and actually, if tissue quality is poor, then there's an increase in the risk of prolapse. But if you've got constant pain, that's just a gigantic muscle, and it's almost a kind of a subliminal thing where you get tight as a defense mechanism, and then it's a sort of learned response to potential sexual activity. So it's kind of, I suppose, partly it's recognizing that and understanding what you have to do to be able to relax that muscle if possible. And it often is, it's not just a single approach that helps ultimately. Yeah. It's a team approach.
Yeah.
Gosh, you've been so helpful, really good, Paula. It's absolutely fascinating. It's such a shame that there isn't a Paula in every surgery.
Yes,
around Britain, because that's kind of what we need, isn't it? We need an expert, because you know, we are 52% of the population. So
I kind of think this is not that difficult a concept, and it's not a dangerous. There's not many treatments.
Not expensive either, is it?
Not expensive. There's not many contraindications to the treatment. So I've been working a long time, and if I spent the last 10 years before I retire helping make this, you know, raise awareness about this problem, I would be really happy. And I think that could make such a big difference to quality of life of lots and lots of women.
Well, I think you'll definitely have made an impact on our listeners today and given them so much helpful information. And we will put links on our Facebook group to all the resources that, Paula, you've mentioned today. So thank you so much for joining us. It's been lovely to meet you. And thank you for all the work you've been doing over the last 3 decades for women. It's amazing.
So food has cropped up quite a bit in the show today, hasn't it, Trish? And I don't know about you, but one thing that has tipped me over the edge during these long days at home with my 3 teenagers is their diabolical eating habits. Mm. I never know whether to say anything about these unhealthy or disordered eating habits or whether to just leave it alone. I mean, it's a minefield, food and teens, isn't it?
Oh, God, it really is. And a lot of our listeners have mentioned that they're worrying about it too. I mean, I just constantly every day, I feel like I've stopped a bit, but I probably have spent a lot of my years parenting worrying about food. So I think it's great that you've spoken to 2 experts, I believe, today, haven't you, who've shared some really good advice with us.
Yes. So for How to Win at Midlife, this section of our show, I have chatted with Anita Clare from the Positive Parenting Project. She is a coach and author of The Work Parent Switch, How to Parent Smarter, Not Harder. She's an expert in child development and runs a peer-to-peer website, Whatever Together, where parents of teens can talk through their issues anonymously. And I also talked to Sam Perkins, who is a nutritionist of the website Happy Eater, which is very helpful for parents. This is what they advised. Brace yourself, Trish. Don't panic. That's their number one piece of advice. Now, Anita is really clear on this, and she says the good news is that all the evidence points to teenagers returning to healthy eating habits, probably those you kind of laid down before they were 11, as soon as they leave their adolescent years. She says all your messages about healthy food will definitely have sunk in. So keep calm and keep the negative chat to yourself, because it's going to be okay in the end. And as Sam, nutritionist, says, it's almost impossible to change eating habits during the teen years, but she is seeing quite a few more teens now who are developing eating disorders during lockdown. So please try and avoid making food this potential battle zone with your teens. Don't criticize or critique their eating, no matter how tempting that is, because what feels like a small comment to you will feel absolutely huge to them, hugely negative. So try and reframe the conversation. You could reframe it sideways, perhaps, by talking about getting active instead of eating and food, and how they could do that, what they could do to move, basically. So maybe push the chat in that direction without demanding anything from them, or maybe talking generally about healthy lifestyles.
And Anita's second piece of advice is that teens need to reject parental values around anything and everything. So if you think about it, they do, don't they? They just don't want to do what we do. And even with logical subjects like food, and obviously they will have had education around this at schools, we do it in the home, but they need to feel in control over what they eat. So we just have to let them get on with it, because it's about forming their identity, having the power to make their own choices. And obviously this is more kind of relevant in lockdown when every other way of doing that for them has been taken away from them because they have very little control at the moment. And I think if you try to stop them eating anything they choose to eat, it's going to end up in a power battle, which is not going to really help. So the positive things to do really in that situation are try and encourage them to cook with you, shop with you, and then set limits yourself on the amount of unhealthy food you bring in the house. But try and do it in a collaborative way so you kind of get their buy-in and say, right, crisps is... Thursday is a crisps day, Saturday is a cake day or whatever. You get them to agree to it and then they have these treats to look forward to. So your language should be about what you worry about, not what they are doing. So you can say, I worry that 6 packets of Quavers in a row is harmful to you. It's my problem, but what do you think? So I think shifting the language in that way, that it's being your problem, not theirs, is going to help as well.
Yes, I think that's a very useful piece of advice. Her other piece of advice is to prioritise your relationship with them. So focus on that. So your connection with them is a priority over their relationship with what you see as unhealthy food. If you lose the connection, they're not going to listen to anything you say. So try and keep your focus on staying close to them and not interfering with their food choices. This is the long game and it requires quite a lot of patience, I think. Yeah. There are some practical things that you can do in collaborating with your team. You could perhaps set a kitchen curfew for safety reasons. I mean, we say no cooking after midnight because we're in bed and we don't want the house to catch fire. Mm. So they happily agreed to that. You can keep your connections with them by doing little things like maybe wandering in with some fruit. I cut up apples and leave them all lying around the house or pop in during their school break times. She says you can make some milkshakes, you can leave nuts and seeds about, things that they'll nibble on absentmindedly, or you can ask them to cook with you to prepare Sunday lunch perhaps. You should be trying to get them to eat with you at least once a week. Also, you should ask them how they want to prepare food and when they want to do it so that they're collaborating with you. But it's all in this very non-judgmental, non-critical way. And you just need to try and avoid them getting into a nocturnal eating routine. So the curfew should help with that.
And I think Anita's overwhelming message really, isn't it, is to keep all language around food as positive as possible and not demonize it. And this is the same for body image. So never refer to food in association with what your child, your teen looks like or how it will affect them. So it's better to talk in general terms about healthy food, but not in reference to them. So we do have to kind of grin and bear it, I'm afraid. And remember that all the normal empowering happy moments which boost their self-esteem have been taken away from them in lockdown.
Yeah,
their sports, their friendships, their kind of exciting things to look forward to. So the last thing they need is you worrying out loud about what they eat and how it affects their bodies. And this is a good one. It's Scarlett O'Hara, isn't it? Gone with the Wind.
Yes.
Gone with the Wind. And remember, tomorrow is another day. Yeah. So if you feel you have not handled this issue well,
guilty,
me too, totally. You can always start again tomorrow.
Yeah, that is the best piece of advice. Sam, the nutritionist, also says that they do need regular snacks. So maybe instead of viewing it as meals, view it as snacks, because when their blood sugar drops, that has adverse effects on their mood, as we know. So if you can keep them snacked up to the eyeballs, as we say here, that will keep their blood sugar levels consistent. Mm-hmm. And the smoothies, you know, you can make a smoothie out of Weetabix and fruit and milk.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm. Leaving fruit bowls in their room, bowls of cereal beside their laptops, just constantly snacking. Things that they should have, if you can ask them, is a vitamin D supplement, 10 milligram vitamin D supplement, maybe B12 supplements as well, particularly if they're veggie or vegans. And iron supplements for girls because of the blood loss during their periods and maybe they're not eating meat. So it's a little bit about doing those little things and really, really not saying anything at all. I know that's hard, but as we said, it's the long game. If you are worried, though, that your child, your teenager has drastically changed her eating habits, then you should, or his eating habits, you should absolutely talk to your GP for advice. We're here, Trish. Nostalgia noodling. Are you ready?
Well, I'm ready, but I'm going to make a little prediction. I bet yours is going to be about food because we've talked a lot about food today, is it?
It is.
Oh, gosh. Yes.
Well, you are telepathic as well. Mm. We do know this about you, don't we? Like a cat, like a little feline reading my mind. Shall I go then?
Yes, please do.
Because basically my nostalgia noodle is things that make you want to eat chocolate, which is basically most of everything in my life. So I have been watching Real Marigold Hotel.
Oh,
I was watching that when Paul Nicholas was on.
Oh, yes.
Which took me down the things that make you eat chocolate route, because I was then remembering
Whisper Bars from 1981. Do you remember them? And then Paul Nicholas was in an advert with Jan Francis because they were in Just Good Friends, weren't they?
Yes, I love that show.
Yes, and they basically launched the Whisper Bar, which is one of my favourites. What is it better than an Aero?
Is it not sort of the same as an Aero?
No, well, an Aero's kind of in it.
I know, but you used to be able to just get normal plain Aeros, but then I think they turned them into a Whisper, didn't they?
Well, I don't know. I have to consult my history of chocolate in the library.
History of chocolate encyclopedia.
Yes. Is yours food?
Mine's not food. Mine is about tape recorders. Do you remember those little sort of, they were like a rectangular box and they had little sort of almost keys that you had to press these buttons.
These are the things that are in those time capsules that Blue Peter buried in 1904.
Well, do you remember like Sunday night was very important because it was the top 40 countdown. Yeah. It might have even been the top 20 way back in the day. And the trick was to try and record the songs. You'd put your little tape recorder next to the radio. And you'd have to get the press. Exactly. The press and record next to each other at the same time. And I always, there was one song, and I don't know why this sticks in my head, but I always got it every week. And it was, do you remember David Soul, Don't Give Up On Us Baby?
Oh, for God's sake.
I don't know why. I think I must have been going through a sort of
cardigan phase.
Cardigan's Hutch post.
Yeah. He would have been your type then, I imagine.
Yeah, but David Soul. Not Starsky, a bit hairy for me, Starsky.
What did you miss? You got the first three bars, did you?
Yeah, I think so. I think I always managed to, and I wanted the whole song. But
well, you're not very technical now, Ish. I can't imagine you would have been
pressing
better
two
then.
Buttons at the same time.
And then you would have got very angry as well, I can imagine as well.
Very upset.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Postcards from Midlife. Thanks for listening, and if you enjoyed it, tell your friends and all the midlife women you know. And remember to subscribe on your podcast provider and rate and review us too, please. And if you could download instead of listening on the Wi-Fi, that would be super helpful for us.
And don't forget to join us on the Facebook group. Also on Instagram or email, you can contact us at hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.